under advisement. The court is going to change the order of argument of the remaining cases. The case that was originally scheduled for the second case, Magunda against Ashcroft, will be moved and heard as the last case for argument this morning. The other cases will remain as previously scheduled. So we will hear argument now in the case of Lucas against the Chicago Transit Authority. Mr. Batwell.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court. In 1997, the CTA accepted Lucas's complaint of racial discrimination. They conducted an internal review, and they found, for cause, that there was racial discrimination. They told Mr. Lucas that. Lucas understood at that time that he had obtained the relief he sought. Unknown to Lucas, Vice President Pat Harney told James Blatz and Ray Schrix that he didn't believe the findings and that they would not be disciplined. Lucas did not learn of this until the deposition of Ray Schrix in this case. The CTA led Lucas on. They led him to believe that he had obtained the relief sought. If he had known he hadn't obtained that relief, he would have filed suit in 1997. Relief is an element of any lawsuit. You don't file a lawsuit unless you want relief. The CTA told Lucas he had obtained justice. That was false. The CTA took ample action to equitably toll the statute of limitations in this case. The district court said no, but I think this is the type of action that would toll the statute of limitations so that we go back to 1997 and all of the incidents at that time. And it's very relevant because James Blatz, in January 18th of 2001, retaliated against Lucas. Lucas moved from the position where Blatz supervised him. He was on the train. He stopped the train between stations. Blatz was on that train. He grabbed Lucas. He told Lucas not to stop the trains between stations. Lucas said he would not stop the trains between stations. Blatz became irate. He suspended Lucas on the spot, and he gave his excuse that Lucas was insubordinate. Insubordinate as to what? Lucas remained quiet after that point, trying to defuse the argument. Blatz is a huge man, 300 pounds. Lucas is very small. He remained quiet. Now, Lucas was taken off the job on the train. When we get to the station platform, Lucas is trying to leave. He's been suspended. Blatz grabs him again, a second time, undisputed. Why would Blatz grab him a second time? He's already been suspended. He tells Lucas, you're suspended again. He grabs him on the shoulder. There's a dispute as to how violent it is. Lucas says it was very violent. Blatz says no. Quintana refuses. Quintana is Lucas's partner. He refuses to say it was violent, and he refuses to say it was nonviolent. I think he's petrified for his job. In any event, Lucas is suspended for 24 days. The court failed to address these incidents, and this is the retaliation by Blatz. Blatz took the first opportunity he had to get Lucas. Now, there's a hearing in front of Frank Machera. Machera gives as the reasons for suspending Lucas that, first, that he stopped the trains between stations. We have 13 trackmen who say they do this all the time, and we have the union representatives who swear out of thousands of grievances no one has ever been suspended or disciplined for stopping the trains between stations. So they go to the second reason, insubordination for refusal to respond back to Blatz, who is irate, yelling. Lucas is remaining quiet, trying to defuse the situation by doing nothing and trying to get away, in fact. So this is the insubordination?
Well, it was also a matter of filing a false charge. Right?
Exactly. I was going to get to that. Lucas files a police report. He alleges that he was injured. At the time of the decision that Machado made, he could not have known what the state court would have found. The court eventually found in Blatt's favor. There was a trial, though. But the trial was months after the hearing held by Machado. When we look at the witness's testimony, it was basically Lucas's word against Blatt's. Quintana refused to say it was violent or nonviolent. Flores was equally ambivalent. You don't have enough information here to say it's a false report. There are cases all the time filed, and there's winners and losers. It does not mean the complaint filed is false. You don't have that kind of finding. We didn't have that here. Machado could not have used or known that reason at the time he made the decision.
Couldn't he have made that decision on his own? Why does he have to wait for the disposition?
Well, the reason I think he could not have made the decision on his own is because the CTA has a policy of confirming the testimony when it's one person against another. You have no confirmation of an independent witness here. So under the CTA policy, you would not have a finding that the report was false. You would simply have no finding at all. And also, the retaliation occurred by Blatt's. So I think we have to look to what Blatt's actually did. Not what Machado did. Blatt's made the decision to suspend Lucas right there on the train. Lucas was off work. Without the actions of Blatt's, Lucas wouldn't have had an involvement at all. And this needs to be addressed. The court did not address that. We have other events also of retaliation or events of discrimination. Escoffier, who is Lucas's roadmaster, disciplined Lucas for returning late to lunch. Also Quintana. But others at the same time returned late for lunch, and they were not disciplined. Escoffier wrote him up for going to the credit union. The trackmen all the time go to the credit union in the morning and are allowed to do that. There was an incident where
what adverse employment action did he incur because of the credit union reprimand?
On the credit union, it was just a write-up. But the lunch, there was a half an hour suspension.
Well, you didn't tell us about that to your reply brief, I noticed.
Okay.
Are we allowed to consider that?
Yes, I believe so. I did incorporate in the original brief a great deal of material, all of the facts argued in summary judgment, and I incorporated those facts because I ran out of time. I wanted to address the other issues, but I did incorporate all these facts in the original brief by reference to the plaintiff's statement.
It is our rule that you can't incorporate things by reference.
Okay.
That's the only way to enforce page limits in the brief. Otherwise, you could just incorporate endless things by reference.
Okay. Anyway.
Docking somebody a half hour's pay in adverse employment action?
Well, I believe so. He lost a half an hour of pay, so he lost that. So that would be an adverse employment action. He was also suspended a day on a pushcart incident. Escoffier ordered four trackmen out on the track during rush hour against CTA rules. Lucas was the most vocal. I admit he called the decision idiotic. He didn't call Escoffier idiotic, but it was a very dangerous decision. All four trackmen refused to obey it. They would have been in a blind track area during rush hour on a push cart. It's strictly against CTA rules. All four violated or refused Escoffier's order. Only Lucas was suspended. And the CTA learns of this order. They don't do anything to Escoffier ordering four trackmen out in rush hour. Trains run every 4 or 5 minutes. It's very dangerous. We have other evidence of discrimination. Pamela Beavers changes her story, her finding of racial discrimination, right before the brief. And interestingly, they find the lost investigation file right before Pamela Beavers needs to review it and right before they file the brief. Monty says she gave the file to the litigation department. And at that point, it was lost. Karen Mosby was the CTA internal investigator. So they found it right at the last minute when they needed it. There was a motion to compel this file, by the way. Machado also gives a different reason for his finding in the right before the brief. He says, after giving the other reasons, he says, well, the reason I suspended him is that he didn't attend two hearings. So a totally different change of reason is itself evidence of discrimination. Witness Garza, who was a truckman, he was sitting there. Eric Mennel was preparing him for his deposition. Garza submitted an affidavit saying that Mennel told him the CTA was out to get Lucas. I believe this is an admission against interest by counsel because he was in a position to know. It's also somewhat improper, I believe, to be doing this with a witness right before a deposition. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wood.
May it please the court, Steve Wood on behalf of the CTA. This Title VII case involved two distinct periods of time, according to plaintiff's own allegations. One period of time that lasted approximately 5 months in 1997, and a completely separate period of time that arose in 2000 and 2001. The questions facing the court today are whether the 1997 claims are time-barred and whether the 2000-2001 claims are meritorious and deserve to be taken to trial. With respect to the 1997 claims, they're clearly barred by the 300-day rule. Plaintiffs below attempted, through two different arguments, to reassert those claims, one arguing that the CTA should be equitably stopped to assert a statute of limitations claim, not equitably told, but equitably stopped. The other was that there was a continuing violation involved here, and we could reach back to those 1997 claims. We believe that neither of those arguments had any merit below. District Court rejected both of those arguments, and we believe rightly so. That leaves us with the decision on the 2000 and 2001 claims, which we believe plaintiff has failed to establish any genuine issue of material fact requiring a trial. I'd like to address the 1997 claims first. This is not a case where the discovery rule comes into play. Plaintiff knew in 1997 all of the facts that he needed bring a charge, and in fact he brought an internal claim in which he stated all of those claims. He believed himself to be the victim of discrimination. He believed himself to be involved in a hostile work environment. He knew the existence of those claims when they arose. There's no dispute about that. And based on that knowledge, he filed an internal complaint with the CTA's Affirmative Action Unit. But then he stopped. He did nothing further. He did not come in and file an EEOC charge within the 300 days. In fact, he didn't file a charge with respect to those claims for 3.5 years in February of 2001. Clearly, those claims are time-barred, and the CTA is not equitably stopped to assert its statute of limitations defense to those claims. The cases in the circuit require active steps, things like fraudulent concealment, promising not to assert the statute of limitations, fraudulent documents, other obstructive and deceitful behavior that would stop the assertion of an equitable defense. And here we simply don't have that. The CTA investigated Mr. Lucas's internal claim, issued a letter that there was cause for that complaint, and also said that it would have recommendations to proceed further. It did not say that any specific relief was being granted. The recommendation was provided to the department head, who disagreed with it. Essentially, these are not facts that were stated in the statements of undisputed facts back and forth, but the documents in the record show that this was more of a disparate impact allegation that Mr. Lucas had, that he wasn't being given the same opportunities to train on certain materials, but that Caucasian machine operators were. This was not a case where Mr. Lucas alleged that racial slurs were being used. Well, he didn't allege it until 2001, but at the time that the Affirmative Action Unit was investigating these claims, there were no allegations of epithets and slurs and a racially hostile work environment. Mr. Lucas's knowledge in 2002, when he alleges that he learned during a deposition that nothing had come of his allegation, cannot have any effect on the accrual of his claim in 1997. Plaintiff filed an EEOC charge based on the same information he knew in 1997. He filed that charge in 2001 and then learned in 2002 that the claim went nowhere. There was no knowledge that he had prior to filing his EEOC complaint that nothing had come of the 1997 allegations. He simply wanted to assert them in 2001. He clearly was not misled by anything that the CTA did in its actions in 2001. And in addition, how the CTA resolved internally the claim in 1997 does not create a separate wrong, does not create a separate new cause of action with a new accrual date and a new 300-day time period. Moving on to the continuing violation doctrine, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Morgan case held that the continuing violation doctrine only applied in cases of hostile work environment, what are called non-discrete claims, and did not apply to discrete claims of discrimination. So to the extent that any of plaintiff's claims in 1997 can be considered discrete claims of discrimination, those claims are time barred because he did not file the charge within 300 days. The proper analysis, according to Morgan, was that even with non-discrete claims that are alleged, the continuing violation doctrine must show that at least one act of racial harassment occurred in the timely 300-day period before, and that if that act of racial harassment be connected, be related to the earlier period before we apply the continuing violation doctrine. And finally, Morgan cautions that even where the continuing violation doctrine applies, the employer has its own equitable defenses such as waiver and latches, both of which we asserted. Turning first to the discrete claims, plaintiff's claims from 1997 are very similar to the claims that Morgan alleged as discrete claims in his action. Morgan alleged that he was wrongfully suspended, that he was charged with rule violations for insubordination, that he was denied training opportunities, and that he was falsely accused of threatening a manager. The court characterized those claims as discrete claims subject to the 300-day cutoff and not subject to the continuing violation doctrine. As with Morgan, Mr. Lucas's discrete claims from 1997 are simply time barred. To the extent that there were any non-discrete claims from 1997, the proper analysis doesn't focus necessarily on the claims in 1997 of racial harassment, but whether there is in fact any claim that occurred within the timely period such that you could relate back or go back and argue that those were related to the earlier period. And we believe that there is not a single timely act of hostile work environment that is alleged in this case in the 300-day period. Plaintiff failed to offer any competent, admissible evidence of an act of racial harassment against him that occurred within the proper time frame. That was what the district court's ruling was. That evidentiary ruling is entitled is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard here. Even looking at the allegations in plaintiff's opening brief, however, plaintiff argues that Escorzia used racial slurs against him and treated him and other African Americans differently. But those allegations simply have no foundation. There, as the district court said, it was difficult to tell whether they happened in the 300 days because there was no date attached. There was no place attached. There were no other witnesses who were mentioned as possibly being there. In addition, Escorzia said that at a hearing in 2001, Lucas said that Escorzia said at a hearing that if Lucas be a good little boy, he gets favors too. I mean, we can debate whether that's an optimal management style, but whether it is an act of racial harassment, I think we cannot debate. It simply isn't. The African American union representative who was present said that he did not perceive the comment to be racially motivated at all. A plaintiff cannot create a tribal issue of fact on that point simply by his own subjective and unsupported reaction to that statement. Instead of focusing on an act of racial harassment, plaintiff tries to rely on how other employees perceived the work environment, but that evidence does not show that plaintiff was subjected to an act of racial harassment within the 300-day period. There were various affidavits that African Americans were required to change railroad ties more frequently, they were given harder assignments, They were disciplined more frequently, but again, those affidavits lacked foundation, as the district court held. In essence, what this shows is not only that the continuing violation doctrine does not revive the hostile work environment claims from 1997, but also the plaintiff has no viable hostile work environment claim from the 300-day period, from the timely period as well. Yet even if he were to identify a single act of racial harassment in the time period, he has to show, in order to relate it back to 1997, that it was related to what occurred in 1997. And here he can't do that. Blass was his manager for the five-month period in 1997. Escorzia was the manager for the period in 2000 and 2001. There's no allegation that Escorzia did anything, had any interaction with him with respect to the allegations of discrimination or a discriminatory treatment that he received in 1997. What's more, even if there were some relation to those 1997 claims, plaintiff in this case affirmatively waived those claims when he told senior management at the CTA in 1999 that he chose not to pursue those claims, that he had accomplished what he wanted to accomplish, and that he chose to go no further. That, we believe, constitutes a waiver. In addition, we established that the delay of 3.5 years under the Laches Doctrine had no legitimate justification, that the CTA was prejudiced by that delay, and for those additional reasons, the 1997 claim should not be considered in this case and are time barred. Essentially, that leaves the disparate treatment and retaliation claims from the 2000 and 2001 period, the timely claims within the 300 days. Under the burden-shifting analysis, plaintiff simply did not establish a prima facie case with respect to those claims. The January 18th suspension after the interaction between Quintana, Lapp, and Lucas on the L train, the reason for that suspension was falsification of reports to the police and the CTA. Plaintiff showed no similarly situated employee who received more favorable treatment.
What do you do with the argument that the falsification of the report had not really been verified?
I have not before today heard the argument about a CTA policy that required the CTA not to issue a finding if there was a dispute. I'm not aware of that. I don't believe that that's in the record or exists.
Apparently, no other authority, though, had indicated the report was false at that time, right? There's still pending allegation, right?
Absolutely. And it was Mahara's decision. It was not, and Mahara didn't have to wait until, the police report, the complaint went through and was prosecuted to determine whether he believed that discipline was appropriate in the
system. Let's talk about the return from lunch situation. I mean, it seems here you've got a little bit of a problem. Now, number one, you do have a similarly situated employee who wasn't disciplined, but who is of a different race than the plaintiff here. Number two, you apparently do have an adverse employment action because you docked the man half an hour pay.
I believe what the facts showed was that both plaintiff and his Hispanic partner were both disciplined and were both docked a half an hour pay from coming back from lunch late. There are allegations that a third, I believe Hispanic employee, who took the same lunch hour and came back at the same time, was not docked. But there's no allegation that Escorzia was aware of that incident and chose not to dock him because of a racial issue.
Well, the plaintiff's partner was of what race?
He was Hispanic. Quintana was Hispanic. So I believe that the statement of undisputed facts shows that they, in fact, both were disciplined.
So your view is that there may have been somebody, two fellows were disciplined, two weren't. Whatever the reason for the disparate treatment, it wasn't race, because the two guys who were disciplined, one was of Hispanic origin, one was of African-American origin.
Precisely, Your Honor. With respect to the June suspension and the August suspension, again, these are instances where plaintiff himself admits to conduct he said he told his supervisor that an order was stupid and idiotic. He refused another order, walked away from the job site. In both of those instances, he does not provide the court with any evidence that a similarly situated employee was treated more favorably than he. The retaliation claims suffer from the same defects. The January 2001 suspension, plaintiff did not show that he was performing his job in a satisfactory manner when he was insubordinate to a superior and false reports with the CTA and with the police department. With respect to the June suspension, again, they were, I give my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Boutwell?
The arguments you've just heard from defendant's counsel show probably the most important decision you will decide is, and that's whether an internal review process has to have substance, because I believe the courts want these claims to be resolved internally by the employer so you don't have as many cases. That goes by the wayside if these internal review processes don't have to have any substance. If you can tell an employee that he's won, that he got the relief he decided, he went after, and then if management can secretly say, we don't believe the decision, and not tell the claimant, and we have that, proof positive, the testimony is undisputed, if you have that situation and there's no sanction, what will other employers do in this situation? At a minimum, equitable tolling should apply here, or equitable estoppel, they're very close. At a minimum, these sanctions, if you would call it that, should apply in a situation like this. I go back, relief is an essential element of any filing. If Lucas believes he has the relief, he should not file in court. And he didn't. He thought he had the relief, that's why he said, hey, I'm not going to go after it further, he ruled my way. But the CTA really didn't rule the way, his way, because secretly, Blatz and Strix were told by the vice president, I don't believe it, and I'm not going to do anything to you. And we see the catastrophic, at least from Lucas's standpoint, the catastrophic result of this. He lay in the weeds, if you want to use Bruce Pinsky's language. He took the first opportunity he had to get Lucas, and that was on January 18, 2001, where by chance he was riding the train, and he goes after Lucas for an event no other trackman has ever been disciplined for, stopping a train to go to lunch. Why did they do this? They can repair the tracks longer. They can work longer. There's a bona fide reason to take the train back so they can work longer, either going to or from the job, and trackmen do it all the time. They all testify to that effect. Also, I note that Gratz could not have known of any report whatsoever at the time he suspended Lucas on the train or on the station. So, and if you look at what Gratz did, you have clear retaliation. Clear retaliation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.